Welcome. The Higher Ed Committee, Higher Ed Workforce Development Committee is called to order on Tuesday, January 22nd. Thanks very much. And before we begin today's presentation, I just wanted to say a couple things about the governor's budget. And so we won't be talking about it today, but we can't just step over it and not address it. So what I would say is that the governor's budget signals a value statement. And the value statement that I heard loud and clear is that we must invest in education. We must invest in our future. We must invest in our young people, in our earliest learners, and in our post-secondary. And so I appreciate that. I applaud that. Now, having said that, you know, the budget is a moving animal in that you take out any one piece and then what's the repercussions to the rest of the plan. And so I don't sit here today and say, oh, that's exactly what's going to happen, because in order for, you know, a new investment to be made, then you have to pass a new revenue source. And so all of that will be moving, and we don't know how it'll end up. But I do want to say for the record that I appreciate the commitment to higher ed that that budget proposal made. So, again, before our presenters, anybody else want to say anything about that? We're open, you know. Nothing? Okay, no comments. Okay, and then last order of business, the staff has been introduced, the members have been introduced, but we've had one partisan staff member who hadn't been here during the introduction, so I just want to give that person a chance to introduce themselves.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members. I'm Ed Cook, and I work for the Republican Senate Republican Caucus as a researcher.
Very good. Thanks. Okay, Chancellor Rosenstone, we're going to turn it over to you. Thank you very much for being here. And actually, both of you and their information about them and their biographies are here. We have Trustee Tom Renier. Did I say that correctly? Okay. With us as well. And so we'll let Chancellor Rosenstone, you dictate how you want to do the presentation.
Fantastic. Good afternoon, Chair Bonhoff, members of the committee. It's a great pleasure on a very Minnesota day to be with you all today. We appreciate the opportunity to visit and look forward to today's discussion. As Chair Bonhoff indicated, I'm joined today by Tom Renier, who's a vice chair of our Board of Trustees and also chair of our Human Resources Committee. Trustee Renier has been president of the Northland Foundation since it was founded in 1986. This is one of the state's six initiative foundations and serves the northeastern part of Minnesota. I'm also joined today by Trustee Brett Anderson, who's here, a student member of our Board of Trustees. What I thought I'd do is just give you an overview of what I think might be a game plan for today's discussion. I want to start with a very quick snapshot of the profound impact that our colleges and universities have on the economic prosperity of Minnesota and on communities across our state. Then I, with your permission, would like to ask Trustee Renier to describe the board's role in setting our strategy for our colleges and universities and holding campus and system leadership accountable. I then want to turn to describe and discuss for you our hundreds of thousands of students that we serve each year, their diverse backgrounds, and the role that we play in helping to deliver the workforce needs needed by Minnesota so we can compete globally. Next, I will highlight some of our long-standing efforts to reduce costs and increase efficiency. And finally, I'll touch on what I think are some of the urgent challenges facing the state.
and our campus and system leaders. Minsky is a tremendous state resource. Our campuses are key to the economic success of Minnesota's regional and local economies. Our colleges and universities offer students from all backgrounds the opportunity to create a better future for themselves and their families. The board clearly understands the critical role Minsky plays in ensuring Minnesota's prosperity and that our collective success as a state requires Minsky's active participation in addressing the fiscal and policy changes that we face. In addition to focusing on the big picture and the future, we also set policy, including system planning, academic programs, fiscal management, personnel, admissions requirements, tuition and fees, and rules and regulations. We appoint campus and system leadership and ensure our ongoing ability to attract and retain top talent. We examine and approve all major decisions. Examples include things like large expenditures, approval of budgets and tuition decisions, and capital improvements. We audit financials and track compliance. For example, at our January meeting, we reviewed our external auditor's report, and we're pleased to receive a clean report with no findings for the third year in a row. Finally, we're engaged in ongoing dialogue with the chancellor about his performance and progress on his work plan. Our focus is guided by the strategic framework, which we developed with Chancellor Rosenstone over the months following his appointment. We formally adopted the strategic framework by unanimous vote 1 year ago in January of 2012. The framework is the genesis of the accountability and results we are demanding and the actions being taken by the Chancellor and by our presidents. It articulates three commitments. First, ensuring access to an extraordinary education for all Minnesotans. We pride ourselves on the fact that we serve students from all backgrounds and all levels of academic ability. Our focus is on the capabilities of our graduates, on providing a quality education that ensures that they are prepared for work, life, and citizenship. One of the actions we're pursuing here is deepening our partnership with communities traditionally underserved by higher education to improve college readiness, recruitment, and success. Second, we're committed to being the partner of choice to meet Minnesota's workforce and community needs. The most visible examples of the work being done here are actions to more closely align our programs with the needs of the business and community employers. Chancellor Rosenstone will say more about these efforts, which are in response to the workforce listening sessions that we held around the state in partnership with DEED and the Minnesota Chamber. Third, we are committed to delivering to students, employers, communities, and taxpayers the best value, most affordable higher education option. As part of this commitment, we are pushing very hard on improving completion rates. This is a priority of the board and is contained in our legislative priorities. Another example here is the outstanding work being done across the system to continue to reduce costs. The chancellor will also provide details. I want to make one more comment before turning my presentation back to the chancellor. I'm serving my second term as a trustee. My observation is that many of the advantages envisioned when this system was created are now coming to fruition. Students are more empowered, they have more choices, can put together degree programs more efficiently, and transfer is far more seamless. There is much greater efficiency and effectiveness in system operations. One board, 43 presidents at the founding of the system have been reduced to 31. Balanced budgets, one IT platform for online courses, HR, finance, and student services. And finally, much greater focus on setting priorities and much stronger accountability for delivering results. With that, I'll turn it back to the Chancellor.
Thank you. In one moment, just a question, if I might, and members, if you have questions for Mr. Rainier, might as well ask now.
Sure.
How often do you meet?
We meet, we take off July and February, I believe it is. So we meet monthly, And the length of those meetings is determined by the agenda rather than an established time. So it's not 2 days, 2.5, 1.5. If there's business, that's how long we meet. I think there's enough business for this board to meet that often.
And what would you say, how would you characterize the culture of the trustee board?
I would say that it's very collegial. We don't all come from the same place in terms of background, political, economic, et cetera. But I sense that there's a very, very strong commitment on the part of every individual on that board to the system and to making it better. So we have our moments of debate, as do you, but generally speaking, I think when it comes to what benefits our students, we're all of one mind.
I actually think if you don't have a strong and healthy debate, then you're not really a very effective board.
Absolutely.
So. Any other questions? And at some point, you don't have to do it right now, Chancellor, but if you might just contrast, just for our education, not in a positive or negative, the difference in the trustee structure of MNSCU versus the regent role at the University of Minnesota, given your background and where you came from, it might be interesting. Go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Bonhoff. Where I'd like to start, if possible, is with our students.
Good.
430,000 students. That makes us the fifth largest system of higher education in America. We're a place of hope and opportunity, a place where students from all walks of life, from all over the state, come to prepare themselves for the jobs that need to be done for communities across Minnesota to be prosperous. We serve everyone with a high school diploma or a GED. We pride ourselves in the number of Minnesotans we serve, not in the number we turn away. We pride ourselves in the quality of our graduates, not in the ACT scores of our freshmen. If you look at all of the people in Minnesota who are at an undergraduate program somewhere in the state of Minnesota, 58% of all those individuals are enrolled in one of our colleges or universities. And if you just focused only on Minnesotans who are undergraduates in the state of Minnesota, that 58% would jump up to 65%. We're a big part of what education is in our state. Demand for our programs has grown dramatically over the last decade, up 18% in number, a little larger increase at our colleges than at our universities. And our students represent the breadth and diversity of Minnesota. We serve not only students right out of high school, but adult learners and workers and professionals retooling to update their skills or prepare for new careers. We serve more students of color than any other higher education provider in the state of Minnesota, nearly 60,000 students of color in 2012. We serve more low-income students than all the state's other higher education options combined. And we're dedicated to helping Minnesotans, veterans, and their families with their education and transition into civilian life, and I'll say just a little bit more about that in just a moment. And as you know, the state of Minnesota has an absolutely spectacular post-secondary education opportunity program, PSEO, which allows high school students to receive college credit while they're still in high school. 82% of all the PSEO students in the state of Minnesota are served by one of our colleges or universities. Our students are from Minnesota. Our graduates get jobs in their chosen fields, and our graduates stay right here in Minnesota to work and contribute to the quality of Minnesota's life. We confer each year over 41,000 degrees, certificates, and diplomas. And in doing so, we provide the workforce that is the engine of Minnesota's prosperity, as the facts on this slide illustrate. To just try to make it a little more tangible, just give you an example, and this will not be on the final exam for this committee. If you go to the Mayo Clinic and ask the question, which college or university in the nation, or for that matter, in the world, has the largest number of employees at the Mayo Clinic? The answer is Rochester Community and Technical College. From admission to discharge, the healthcare professionals are trained by our colleges and universities. Surgical and primary care nurses, surgical technologists, clinical lab scientists, health unit coordinators, health information management specialists, nursing assistants, medical transcriptionists, histology technicians, and the list goes on and on and on. As I mentioned, we've made a very strong commitment to serving veterans. This year, over 10,600 veterans are enrolled in our colleges and universities, a 57% increase over the last 4 years. We have veteran-friendly policies and support services at every single one of our colleges and universities. We award academic credit for prior training and prior experience in the military. And this last spring, Gina Sabania, who's with us today, traveled to Kuwait to ensure that members of the 134th Brigade Combat Unit, the Red Bulls, who were ending deployment in the Middle East, could have a smooth transition to academic programs that would best prepare them for successful civilian careers. Our colleges and universities also deliver 16,000 customized training, occupational, and professional classes to businesses and other employers throughout the state to ensure that more than 120,000 employees each year stay at the leading edge of their professions so they are productive and Minnesota businesses can remain competitive. In short, we are focused on meeting the workforce needs of Minnesota. And as the needs of our students have changed, and as the workforce needs of Minnesota have changed, we too have kept pace. E-education is just one example. We have grown e-education exponentially, a tenfold increase in enrollments over the last decade. Now, e-education is not the silver bullet. It doesn't work for everybody. All those health professionals I described at the Mayo Clinic, probably we don't want all of them trained online. Certainly if I'm the patient, we don't. But we also know that for some kind of learners, e-education is not always the best mode of delivery. The other thing we need to keep in mind is that 3/4 of all the students who are taking an online course in one of our colleges, universities, are also taking face-to-face courses in one of our colleges and universities. Put differently, it's part of the portfolio available to meet the work needs and work styles and lifestyles of our students, but it's not an either-or deal that some people sometimes think it is. Another way in which we've tried to keep pace is to ensure that our academic programs are aligned with Minnesota's workforce needs, a topic to which I now want to turn. The place to begin was very simple. If we want to understand what the workforce needs are in Minnesota, we better sit down and do some listening. And that's exactly what we did. In partnership with DEED and with the Chamber, we went out and listened to understand the answer to the question, what does Minnesota need to prosper? We held 55 listening sessions around the state of Minnesota, covering 9 industry sectors: manufacturing, healthcare, IT, engineering, energy, transportation, agriculture, food production, natural resources, mining, and financial services. We engaged business leaders to help us understand their current and future workforce needs. There are a couple common themes. We heard about the shortage of qualified, experienced workers with technical 2-year and 4-year degrees. We heard about the demand for additional workers for continuing education for their employees. We heard about the need not only for technical skills, but for these more foundational skills like critical thinking, communications, teamwork, collaboration, leadership, and problem solving. And employers across every one of these sectors also made it very clear that they want graduates with hands-on experience. Graduates who are trained on the latest technologies and equipment, graduates who've gained experiences through internships and apprenticeships. We have begun taking action to respond to what it is we heard, and the priorities that we'll be discussing when we get together in a couple weeks will ask for some help to realize those lessons that we learned from the listening sessions. But there's additional steps that we've already begun to take. First thing we've done is to ensure that every one of our academic programs across the entire system has defined learning outcomes that specify very clearly what the skills and capabilities will be of those students who graduate from each of those programs. Programs that already had learning outcomes in place have revisited them to make sure that they're aligned with what we heard. And one of the great advantages we have in our colleges and universities in going through this exercise is that we can draw upon the advice of industry specialists who serve on our program advisory committees and can help make sure that the outcomes we're delivering are indeed the outcomes they need when they're looking for talent from our graduates. The other thing that we've done is to adjust course offerings and the content of our courses to align also with what we've heard in those listening sessions. And there's a number of examples that appear on this slide, but let me offer a couple additional ones to give you a flavor of the changes we have made to ensure that we're aligned with the workforce needs of Minnesota. For example, Ridgewater College added faculty and class sections to meet the need of more graduates necessary in the field of precision farming techniques. Dakota County Technical College expanded its diesel mechanic program because of what we heard at the listening sessions on transportation. M-State increased the number of students in the electrical line program because of what we heard at the energy listening sessions. MSU Moorhead developed a certificate program to boost graduates' communication skills because of what we heard across every one of these listening sessions. And 13 of our colleges increased the number of course sections or added new programs in critical manufacturing fields, again, in response to what we heard in the workforce listening sessions. In short, our colleges and universities have already begun the process of aligning their academic programs with the workforce needs of Minnesota. There's much more to do to ensure that we're turning out the right number of graduates in the right places with the right kind of skills, and I do look forward to continuing this part of the conversation when we're together in a couple weeks. But now I'd like to turn to our next topic, which is access, affordability, and efficiency. When it comes to access and affordability for students from all walks of life, we like our model compared to the alternatives. We are Minnesota's most affordable higher education option, and as Trustee Rainier suggested, we plan to keep it that way. Over the past 12 years, the real cost of delivering a Minscu education, real cost meaning controlled for inflation, is actually down 10%. We've accomplished this by serving students smarter. Our faculty are serving more students. We are using our facilities more efficiently. A 20% increase in the student credit hours generated per square foot over the last decade. We're making much better use of technology. We're eliminating high-cost, low-demand programs, and we are aggressively reducing administrative costs. The tight control of costs is not new to Minscu leadership or to our campus leadership. It is not new to this Board of Trustees. By any measure, over the years, Minscu has been on a steady trajectory of reduced administrative overhead and increased efficiency, and that trend will continue as long as I serve as chancellor. Here are the facts for Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. Between 2008 and 2012, although student enrollment at our colleges and universities increased 11%, the total number of employees across the system at our colleges, at our universities, and in the system office remained flat, absolutely flat. Compared to other higher education systems throughout the nation, Minscu administrative spending per FYE student ranks 37th out of 50, And that's a list where you want to be near the bottom, not near the top. Administrators represent...
Excuse me, Mr. Chancellor. Is that a published list where...
We can share with you the analysis, Chair Bonhoff, that produced that figure.
Thank you.
So there will be transparency around it if you need it.
Thank you.
Administrators represent approximately 3% of all employee headcount. And this drive for administrative efficiency has taken place both at the system office and at our campuses. This chart shows the amount of administrative or institutional support that exists, the green line at our colleges, the blue line at our universities. And by institutional support expenditures, I mean everything from the president's office to the business office to the accounting staff to HR to IT, the whole kit and caboodle. And it's declined over the last 5 years from 10.3% of total expenditures in 2008, down to 9.2% of total expenditures in fiscal year 2012. There's also been significant improvement at our universities, the blue line, declining from 10% of total expenditures in 2008, down to 8.8% in 2012. And this drive for administrative efficiency has existed not only at our colleges and universities, but in the system office as well. The system office budget in nominal dollars, no hanky-panky for inflation, in nominal dollars, is 24% smaller than it was 4 years ago. And system expenditures as a percentage of general revenue for the entire system have declined from 3% in 2009 down to 2.3% in 2012. There are fewer administrators in the system office than there were a decade ago. In fact, there are fewer employees of all kinds in the system office than a decade ago, with one exception. Information technology employees, who are usually part of MAPE. These are the employees that we've added to support the technology that's there to serve our students and the technology that's there to support online education and the hundreds of thousands of students who are served each year online. Now, these are real successes. This is our track record with respect to administrative expenses. But we are not resting on our laurels. Key to reducing costs is a new initiative that was begun in 2011 to completely rethink and redesign the way we deliver services across our colleges and universities. And we've moved in the last year from planning and analysis to execution. The Campus Service Cooperative, as it's called, simply put, is a game changer. It is a complete fundamental redesign of business processes, human resource processes, financial aid processes, and procurement practices. Savings are already being realized, and these savings remain on our college and university campuses and will grow over the years ahead, allowing us to continue to hold down costs and continue to make MNSCU an even more cost-effective education than it is today. Now, the Board of Trustees has been pretty hard-nosed about tuition, and they have held the line on tuition and fees over the years. Since 2005, undergraduate resident full-time tuition and required fees, minus the scholarships and grants that students get, has remained steady as a percent of the median family income. It's gone up a bit, but it has not gone up faster than family income. I guess it's orange line at the top is the line for our universities. The green line at the bottom is the line for our colleges. And the red line in the middle is the average for the system as a whole. They've held the line on tuition. Now, every single person in this room is concerned about student debt. We are too. But we have to be clear about where the debt is occurring. The bar chart at the top of this page looks at student debt across three sectors of higher education. The public four-year universities, this is us, our seven universities, and the University of Minnesota. The private not-for-profit four-year universities and colleges that award baccalaureate degrees, and the for-profit colleges and universities that award baccalaureate degrees. So the bar charts are focusing on BAs or BSs. At the public universities, that is the University of Minnesota and our seven state universities, 23% of the graduates had absolutely no debt compared to 3% who graduated from the for-profit sector. 16% of the graduates had more than $30,000 of debt compared to 81% of the graduates from the for-profit sector. The data in the table at the bottom of the page looks at the comparison for associate degrees. So if you graduate from one of Minsky's colleges with a two-year associate's degree, the median debt for the graduates is $7,480. And if you graduate from one of the for-profits with an associate's degree, the median debt is $21,780. Notice the difference in that first column between the percent who graduate with debt. Nearly every single graduate from one of the for-profits has debt, and it's substantially higher than the debt that students have when they graduate from one of our colleges. So what's the bottom line for Minsky? The latest data that we have is displayed on this chart. The median debt for a student leaving our system with a certificate is $1,167. The median debt for a student leaving with an associate's degree is $7,208. And the median debt of a student leaving with a baccalaureate degree is $15,300. We care deeply about even that level of debt, but it's important to distinguish that level of debt from some of the stories we read about in the newspaper. They're not stories coming out of our colleges or universities. Now I'd like to just shift gears one more time, Chair Bonhoff, members of the committee, away from Minsky per se to the state of Minnesota as a whole, and share with you some of the urgent challenges that I think we're facing as a state. And if you will, use this as a segue for the conversation we'll have in a couple weeks when we talk about the current legislative session. The first challenge is one I think you're all familiar with. We've been reading about it now for a couple years. And that is Minnesota's immediate and growing skills gap. I have heard from companies around the state of Minnesota about the dire need for workers with advanced skills, particularly in manufacturing, biotech, and healthcare. The painful reality is this: even with 5.5% unemployment, which is a good news that we got last week from December, there are still 165,000 Minnesotans without work. And the most painful part of that story is many of those unemployed Minnesotans simply do not have the education they need for the new economy. That's a significant challenge facing Minnesota, and it's something together we need to meet. Looking ahead, we are facing a significant shortage of people prepared for the jobs of the future. You know the number. 70% of Minnesota's jobs will require a post-secondary education by the year 2018, and that feels like the day after tomorrow. Half of those 70% will need a baccalaureate degree, and half will need less than a baccalaureate degree, a certificate or associate's degree. Now, if you think about the retiring baby boomers, and that retirement is going to occur over the next 5 to 10 years, and you put that together with the growth in Minnesota's economy that's projected over the next decade, we're going to have to replace or add a grand total of 620,000 jobs that require some post-secondary education if business and industry in Minnesota is going to have the workers they need to continue to grow. That's a staggering number. Now, if we stay on the current trajectory and don't increase the number of post-secondary credentials that we are awarding, we will be approximately 150,000 workers short of the number of workers with post-secondary credentials that businesses and industries in Minnesota need. Now, to meet Minnesota's workforce needs, what that means is that we're going to dramatically have to increase the number of people who are prepared for the jobs of the future. This is absolutely key to Minnesota's prosperity. It's a statewide challenge, and together we have to meet this challenge. The third challenge I'd like to bring to your attention is what we might call a college readiness gap. K-12 preparation is not where it needs to be. About 25% of Minnesotans who start as freshmen in high school do not finish on time. 50% of students of color who start as freshmen in high school do not finish on time. And way too many students, regardless of color, come to our colleges and universities unprepared to begin college-level courses. And that's true not just at our universities, but at our community and technical colleges as well. Minnesota also has the third largest achievement gap in the nation. So the challenge we're facing is that the populations that are growing faster in Minnesota are those least prepared for post-secondary education and therefore least prepared for the jobs of the future. And I submit that in a climatologically challenged state, and we know in the last 48 hours just how climatologically challenged we are, we simply cannot afford to leave anyone behind. Every single high school student has to be prepared to begin post-secondary education and to have sustaining wage jobs for the future. You need to have a post-secondary credential, and we need to work together to ensure that every single Minnesotan is on track to get one of those credentials. That is a huge challenge, but together we have to find a way to meet that challenge. And the last challenge, which I know you're familiar with, is that over the past 12 years, we've seen a steady and deep cut in our state's investment in higher education, and this trend has put at risk our ability to deliver the educated workforce that's needed to keep Minnesota competitive. The cuts in Minnesota have been twice as deep as the national average. Here are the details. The red line represents funding in the state of Minnesota per FYE student in constant dollars. The blue line represents funding in the other states per FYE student in constant dollars. Minnesota support was cut 48%. The national average is a cut of 23%. We moved in a short period of time from being, as Mr. Keeler would put it, above average. In fact, 24% above average as a state, to now not only being not above average, not even being at average, but actually being about 17% behind the rest of the nation in its funding of higher education. Minnesota's reduction is one of the deepest in the nation. Another way to put it is to look at the state budget and ask ourselves, what is the share of the state budget that's been devoted to higher education? This chart is not a Minsky chart. This is a state of Minnesota chart. The previous chart was not a Minsky chart. It, too, was a state of Minnesota chart. And so we've moved from being about 12.2% of the state budget down to 6.9% of the state budget in the current fiscal year. Now, despite our push for efficiency, despite the board holding tuition increases to the level they have, and despite the fact that the cost of the education itself is now 10% less than it was a decade ago, who pays that cost has shifted from the state to our students, as the next chart makes clear. So the blue line represents the share of the pie being covered by our students. The red line, I think that's red, represents the share that's covered by the state of Minnesota. So in a short period of time, we've gone from the state covering two-thirds of the cost and students paying one-third of the cost, to the almost reversal of those ratios, with the state now covering about 40% of the costs and students and families picking up the other 61%. A while ago, it was understood that public higher education was indeed a public good. That concept of education being a critical public good has been put at risk. So one way to think about these challenges is we're facing a perfect storm here. At a time when more and more people need higher levels of education than ever before in our state, that we need to do a better job of preparing more people than ever before for the jobs that will enable Minnesota to be globally competitive. Minnesota has cut its investment in higher education to the point that it's hurting our ability as a state to enable our businesses to get the workers they need for our economy to grow. Education was Minnesota's comparative advantage in the last century. It absolutely must be our comparative advantage in the current century. Now, you might be saying to yourself, so why are you doing this job? I will confess, Madam Chair, to being a card-carrying optimist. I would not do this job if I didn't think there's a way in which we could work together to meet these challenges. And I think together we can meet these challenges, and Minnesota can thrive. The way we've been thinking about this, and this is the segue into our next conversation, is to focus on the outcomes we must provide, we must deliver to ensure Minnesota's prosperity. And the outcomes listed on this slide are the commitments we're making to what we want to deliver with your help over the next 2 years. The legislative priorities we will discuss together at our next session, session meaning not 2 years from now, but session meaning in a couple of weeks, our priorities are laser-beamed focused on delivering these outcomes. Outcomes I think that Minnesota needs, and outcomes you and the good people of Minnesota should expect from their higher education institutions. Delivering these outcomes will have a huge payoff for our graduates. Education increases lifetime earnings and wealth. Education helps people avoid unemployment. Education lifts people out of poverty. In fact, there is no better way to lift people out of poverty than education. But as important as these personal benefits are, education also has a collective payoff for all Minnesotans. An educated workforce enables businesses to grow and communities thrive. An educated workforce attracts new businesses to Minnesota. By working together in new and more powerful ways, we can deliver Minnesota's prosperity. We can deliver graduates with the skills and knowledge required to fill the jobs that need to be done so that businesses and communities can grow and prosper. Through our collective leadership, we can create endless opportunity for future generations of Minnesota. The legislative priorities that we'll discuss at our next hearing will focus on jobs, affordability, and completion. So, Madam Chair, to sum up, we've shared with you the very strong board leadership and strong board oversight of the direction that the system's taking, of its performance, and of the priorities that we have set. We have shared with you the broad and diverse student population that we serve, and the diversity of our students from all walks of life and with all educational backgrounds that we prepare for jobs. We have shared with you the breadth of our endeavor in educating Minnesota's workforce and in producing the workforce necessary for communities across our state to thrive. We have shared with you the details of our administrative efficiencies and our ongoing cost to continue, our ongoing efforts to continue to reduce administrative costs. We've shared with you some of the urgent challenges facing not just Minsku, but facing the state of Minnesota. And we've shared with you the outcomes we want to focus on as we move forward in our discussions over the weeks and months ahead. With that, I will stop holding force and look forward to our discussion.
Thank you very much, Chancellor Rosenstone. So, members, let's open it up for questions. But, Chancellor Rosenstone, will you first go back and answer that first question I asked you with regard to trustee structure comparatively to the region? Just we had a presentation from President Kaler. It just might be interesting for the group to understand the difference.
Chair Bonoff, I was doing my very best to avoid that question, as you might have noted, but I will respond since you've asked now a second time.
Thank you.
I will try not to make it a habit of waiting for the second time for a question to be asked. My experience interacting firsthand with both regents of the University of Minnesota and with trustees is that these are incredibly dedicated citizens. I remember very vividly asking commenting to a member of the Board of Regents at the university when I was there how much we appreciate the work she does on behalf of University of Minnesota. And she corrected me to say, no, I work for the people of Minnesota. And I think that is very much a guidepost that is in the mindset both of regents and trustees. The Board of Trustees that I serve is larger than the Board of Regents. We have three additional trustees compared to the board. Our board meets a little more often. We have more committees that are deeply engaged in the work of our system. Being a larger system, our trustees spend a lot more time traveling around the state to get to learn firsthand the work of our colleges and universities. My experience with both systems is that the board provides pretty close oversight of the CEO and of the priorities that are brought forward. Our board is also very concerned about metrics, very concerned about performance. And in my experience of just one performance review so far, it was a several-hour meeting with a very, very long, detailed conversation, as I suspect it should be. And I suspect, like the CEO's work with the Board of Regents, this is a collaboration. It's a team effort. And I treat the board chair and vice chair in particular, who I interact with most, as colleagues in helping figure out some of the big questions we face. I am on the phone with Vice Chair Rainier and with Chair Hightower at least a couple times a week. I never want them to be surprised. I hope they will never surprise me. But it's mostly to get counsel and to give them a heads up and to ask on tough issues how they would like to proceed and to ensure that the oversight that should be there is being provided at all times.
Thank you very much. And I think as a body that is charged with oversight of MNSCU, that that is relevant to this committee, and that was helpful. Thank you. Members? Yes.
Thank you.
Senator Miller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Chancellor, thank you for the great overview. I'm wondering if you can go a little bit more in depth about the number of employees at the central office or the system office, and then what is the role of the system office and what do you do for the colleges and universities throughout the state?
Yes, I think I can get the exact numbers for you in just a moment. I have that table. But let me, Senator Bonoff, Senator Miller, answer the second part first while we're waiting on the exact numbers. From my point of view, the role of the system office is to help our colleges and universities be successful. And if there's work being done at the system office that is not value added to our colleges and universities, I've stopped it. And part of the deep cuts that occurred during my first year as chancellor were designed to clear out the things that were no longer value-added. Let me give a couple examples of things which I think are value-added. For a system of 430,000 students, 31 presidents, 54 sites, we have just five attorneys in the Office of the General Counsel, and those five attorneys serve the entire system, all colleges, all universities. That's a resource that's available to our colleges and universities that does not require redundancy to exist on those campuses. You may be delighted by the fact that we have just one government relations team as opposed to 31 government relations teams knocking on your door of just three individuals. That's an efficiency that we provide the campuses. The IT platform that we have to support online education that supports our HR systems, that support our financial systems, are maintained at the system office in a way that creates an efficiency rather than having 31 platforms around the state of Minnesota. With respect to finances, we provide oversight. The board has delegated to me the responsibility to provide oversight of our colleges and universities. We have a financial office that helps with financial planning, that helps with institutional research, and it provides the accountability that the board expects me to provide and that, quite frankly, the legislature expects me to provide as well. We have responsibilities to ensure that students can move seamlessly between our colleges and universities, so we need to make sure the transfer policies are in place. There's state statute about academic programs and redundancies and duplication, and we provide oversight of that as well. We oversee the facilities priorities that come forward to the capital investment committees in the House and Senate, building on the input that we get from our colleges and universities. So my focus is on ensuring that what we do in the system office is helping our colleges and universities, not adding additional work or getting in the way of the colleges and universities. The way that I've tried to do that is to completely rethink and redesign the Leadership Council. Leadership Council is comprised of my cabinet, the vice chancellors and directors, as well as all the college and university presidents. The strategic direction that Vice Chair Rainier shared with you was developed with the help of our college presidents. The priorities that we'll talk about when we get together to talk about the 2014-15 request are priorities that come out of our colleges and universities. My job is to listen very carefully to what our presidents need and to ensure that the work of the system office is facilitating their work as opposed to hindering their work. So let me give you the exact numbers that you asked for. The grand total of system-level employees across the entire system, college, universities, and system office, is 15,489 employees. There are 348 full-time employees equivalents in the system office, and that is down, for example, from 2008, where we had 361, 2009, 385, so a real reduction. Again, part of that reduction is masked by the fact that we've added some IT employees to deal with the increase that's occurred in online education and the like. So in nominal dollars, the number of actual employees is down, and it's down even further if you take away the fact that we've had to boost some IT employees to cover the new systems that we've put in place for our students.
Chancellor Rosenstone, would that document be something the members could get a copy of?
Absolutely. We'll make sure that the committee gets copies, yes.
Thank you. Senator, follow up. Go ahead. Senator Miller.
So 348 is the total full-time equivalents in the system office. In your opinion, is there any duplication or any room for improvement or efficiencies, decisions that could possibly be made at the local level, at our local colleges and universities, that are now being pushed up to the system office and then back to the local colleges and universities? And what I'm getting at is I think our local colleges and universities are more connected with their communities than, say, the central office or the system office. And is there still room for improvement in those areas where those decisions can be made locally versus in the system office?
Senator Bonoff, Senator Miller, a very good question. In the abstract, absolutely, there's always room for improvement. Let me say a word or two more about the Campus Service Cooperative. The Campus Service Cooperative is a collaboration across all of our colleges and universities and the system office to figure out what's the best way to deliver those business practices to improve quality, increase efficiency, and continue to reduce costs. I am 100% certain that's going to suggest to us new ways in which we might redesign work to get the right work in the right place to deliver the right quality and keep it aligned with the needs of the campus. I see no reason why work should be done in the system office. It can be better done more effectively, more efficiently, and at a lower cost on one of our colleges or universities. As I believe I said to you last year, I am not interested in building a bigger system office. I am interested in building a system office that better serves our colleges and universities. And if work can stop, I want to stop it. If work is better done on one of our campuses, I want it done on one of our campuses. So the short answer to your question is there's always room for improvement, and that's part of what the Campus Service Initiative is all about, is to identify those places where we can improve and to implement those improvements and reap those savings.
Just one more follow-up.
Yep,
Madam Chair. What's the time frame on that? When will we see the results? Or when will you guys see the results of that?
Chancellor.
Well, Chair Bonhoff, Senator Miller, I hope we'll both see the results. I don't want to keep them secret. We've already begun to see some results. So, for example, payroll in the system office is no longer done in St. Paul. It's actually done out in Perham and Fergus Falls because that campus actually has the best payroll team in the state. So we've already begun to see some of that change already. Our projections are that over the course of the next 2 to 3 years, we're likely to see across the entire system in the neighborhood of $40 to $50 million in savings as a result of this initiative that we've begun. Those savings will be used to help cover some of the efficiencies that we've promised in our biennial request and that we'll use to help cover some of our incremental costs, as opposed to ask for those costs to be covered by our students or by the people of Minnesota. So it's a very aggressive plan, and the numbers will be quite large over the next year, couple years.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Ekin?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Chancellor, I was wondering what the impact was. I'm glad to hear you're trying to hold the line on the tuition increases, but sometimes, you see increases in other areas as a result, like fees, for instance. What kind of increase have we seen in fees, student fees? Also, the cuts that have been coming from the state, if we're holding the line on tuition, obviously, you're talking about efficiencies being found, but have there been programs that have been cut? Do we see course offerings that have been cut, which can actually increase the cost to students who have to maybe go to school longer, another year before they graduate? And if you could address, how many students do have to go longer than what they anticipate to graduate?
Chancellor.
Senator Bonhoff, Senator Ekin, great questions. The board has asked for a complete review of all fees this year as part of our request for the budget for next year, and we'll be providing a complete rundown for the board on fees. Fees, there are two kinds of fees that I want to make sure we clearly distinguish. One are fees that are tied to courses, such as the materials that are expended, or fees that are surcharged on expendables that happen to be there on a particular course. And the other are fees which students assess themselves for some of the things they would like to see on their campus. So, for example, students vote to decide that they'd like to add a fee to improve their student union or to build a parking structure and the like. Both fees, of course, affect costs, but some of those fees are fees that the students decide they want to add, and some of the fees are fees that we need to add for academic reasons. We've tried to hold the line both on fees and on tuition, and we can give you the precise numbers if you'd like, to show what tuition and fee increases have been over the years. And as you rightly note, those increases are really part of the total cost. The effect of the cuts of the last decade have been dramatic. And there's not a single campus you can visit where you won't visibly see those results. In some places, we don't have the technology we need to prepare students for the jobs they'll be taking because we simply haven't had the funds to replace that technology. And in some fields, that technology in 2 or 3 years is obsolete, needs to be replaced. In other places, entire programs have been cut because we can no longer afford, because the state support's not there, to continue those programs. We've tried to be very careful about ensuring that students that began the programs can complete them, but in places there just are no new cohorts being added, and every year there are programs that are cut as a result of that. There are fewer empty seats in our classes. That's what I mean by the faculty teaching more students. We've completely managed our curriculum in a more aggressive way so that we're not opening sections if there's empty seats in other places, and as a result, as you've anticipated, that reduces some of the degrees of freedom available to students. We have, with your help, capped associate degrees at 60 credits and baccalaureate degrees at 120 credits, which means there are fewer students in programs where there's more credits than 60 or 120, which means pushing more students to graduate in a timely fashion rather than build up credits before they actually complete their degrees. Throughout all these cuts, we have done our very best to protect students. Not always perfectly, but we've done our very best to keep students as our priority. But programs have been cut. Equipment has not been replaced. Degrees of freedom have been tightened. Options have been reduced. And those are among the things that we want to be able to put back in place in a very targeted way to improve the quality of what we can provide our students.
Thank you.
Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Chancellor, I was looking at slide 33, where you compared tuition and appropriations. Just as a point of clarification, is appropriations, are we just talking about direct subsidies to the schools, or would that include the state grant program as well?
If I'm not mistaken, Senator Bonhoff, Senator Pratt, the support for the student side of this would be where the state grant would come in. This is only the direct support to the institution. So part of the cost to the student is in effect being subsidized by Pell, by state grant, by institutional grants, and by the scholarships provided by our foundations.
So it would be picked up in the increase of the blue line versus, thank you.
Yes.
Madam Chair?
Yes, thank you, Senator Claussen.
Thank you, Chancellor Rosenstone, for your presentation today. Appreciate it. Very good. Familiar with the concurrent enrollment program. It's a great program for students to get a jump on college at a no cost to parents, and it's a great opportunity for students that are advanced to get ahead in their college opportunity. One concern I have is the cost of that program that's being passed on to the local school districts. And I'm just wondering if we can take a look at that on how we can cut costs in that area so we're not passing those costs back to the local school districts for those credits. I know there is a cap on the total dollar amount that's been allocated for that program, and it hasn't been increasing, but the costs seem to be increasing at a higher rate than what you'd normally expect, shall we say. So yes, that's one comment.
Chair Bonhoff, Senator Claussen, there are two ways in which we do concurrent enrollment, of course, as you well know. One is that the college-level courses are offered by high school faculty with some mentoring and, if you will, certification by our usually college faculty. The second way in which we do it is by a student from a high school coming to one of our college or university campuses and taking the course face-to-face on our campuses. With respect to the first, there are costs that we are incurring to provide those faculty to provide that mentoring and to assure that, indeed, they're college-level courses. Those costs are currently not being covered, and that's part of what we want to talk about next time we're together. On the part of the program that has high school students coming to our campuses to take those courses, we are required by state law to cover the books, to cover the lab fees, and to cover any other incidental fees associated with the course. At our colleges, we are currently providing roughly a $2.9 million subsidy for the students we're currently serving. At our universities, on top of that, we're providing an additional $500,000 in subsidy because the dollars that come under state law from the school district to our university are insufficient to cover the costs of instruction at the university. We would love to grow this program. We'd love to grow this program because it produces huge efficiencies for the state. We'd love to grow the program because if we're concerned about debt, we're concerned about getting students through education in a timely fashion, in a cost-effective fashion for them and their families, it's a great way for students to leave high school with a semester or two or three or four of college credit. We cannot grow that program by asking students who are there paying tuition to subsidize the costs of that program. We'd like to fix it. And so we look forward to having that conversation with you and with the other education committees in the House and Senate to see whether there's a way in which not only can we fix it, but can we grow it to increase the pipeline of students who can get college credit before they graduate high school.
So as I understand it, currently you are not passing those costs back to the school district. You are indeed eating some of those costs, so to speak, as well.
Chair Bonhoff, Senator Claussen, that is exactly correct.
Follow up?
Yep, Senator Claussen.
Articulation agreements. Can we get some statistics on how often those are being used and are they really of value?
Chancellor?
Senator Bonhoff, Senator Claussen, they're literally used every single day. An articulation agreement is an agreement between a college and a university that allows a student to take the credits that she earned at a college and have them count towards a degree at the university. They exist among the colleges and universities within our system, but we also have articulation agreements with the University of Minnesota, with St. Mary's, with McAllister, with all the colleges and universities in the state. The reason they exist is so that we create a clear pathway for the student, so she knows that if she wants to begin and takes the following 12 courses at one of our community colleges, those courses will transfer and will count towards her degree when she moves on to get, for example, a baccalaureate degree. So I can certainly provide you and the committee with a listing of the total number of articulation agreements that exist, but they are used literally every single day by students across the state.
Okay. Thank you.
Follow-up to that, to Senator Klassen's question, Chancellor, how about with regard to out-of-state colleges and universities?
Chair Bonhoff, you have me stumped. I will have to either ask for a lifeline or get back to you on that one.
And, Chancellor, I ask that because we do get that from constituents. Yeah. Their kids want to transfer back to Minnesota and then have complaints with regard to credits, you know, counting from their other institution. I'm sure it's a case-by-case basis.
Chair Bonhoff, I'll have to get back with you on that. I know that there is always a hand-tailoring, if you will, of a student coming from the University of Hawaii who wants to come back to Winona State University. We probably don't want a whole articulation agreement around that, but we do sit with that student and go through the transcript and figure out which courses will transfer. I don't know the answer for sure, but I'm willing to bet that on the colleges and universities that are in bordering states, we probably do have articulation agreements, but I will have to give you details on that a little later.
Thank you. Senator Kent.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Chancellor, I was very interested in the discussion about the alignment with workforce needs, and I'd like to ask you to talk about that a little bit more, specifically in terms of where we are right now and identifying the workforce needs that currently exist and the methodology you've used to identify those, and then also to what degree are you looking down the road? You know, the kids we're educating in fifth grade right now, that's 20 years down the road.
Chair Bonhoff, Senator Kent, great questions. I think there's three parts to getting this to work in a sustainable way for Minnesota. The first part is having very clear, usable information on what the current workforce needs are and what the projections are of those needs going forward. And it turns out that's trickier than you might think. What we discovered in the workforce listening sessions is that the deed data, which is built off Department of Labor data, aren't quite as good as we'd like them to be. In part because of the level of aggregation, in part because of the way the data are built, which is oftentimes off of want ads and the like, in part because there isn't anywhere close to the level of nuance you need to understand the specific skills that are needed. The second thing we learned is that asking employers to tell us what their industry is going to look like a year or two from now is a tougher question for employers than we ever thought, and quite frankly, that many employers ever thought. But we need to skate to where the puck's going to be, and we can't skate to where the puck's going to be if we don't have a sense from employers of what those trends are looking like and what their projections are. So that first part of the puzzle we're committed to solving, and the way we're solving it is with a work group that was created by the Itasca group. They did a wonderful study that I participated in on future of higher education in Minnesota, and one of the priorities they brought forward was alignment of education with workforce needs. So I am co-chairing the work group on alignment with Scott Peterson, who is the HR lead at Schwann's. We have folks from DEED, folks from private colleges, folks from the chamber, folks from the University of Minnesota, and I think it's 9 industry colleagues at the table. And we got to solve that problem and build a sustainable way in which, in real time, we can always get the answer to that question. So that's part one. Part two is our responsibility. We need to respond to that and, quite frankly, not respond on university time, but respond on real-world time. By that, I mean we don't appoint 6 committees and talk about it for 5 years, but rather be able to respond like that because the puck's continuing to go down the ice and we got to be there when it gets there as well. That's what we've started to do. That's what it means to reassess and to make sure we have learning outcomes with each of our programs. That's what it means, even in a six-month time frame, to be able to adjust what programs we have, what things need to be taught in their programs, where we need to grow, and where we need to shrink. That's our responsibility. We have a board that's going to help drive that. That's the examples I shared with you. And then the third part of the puzzle has to be to take all this information we have about workforce needs and get it earlier in the pipeline. Because we can't have students graduating high school without a clue of what their next step is. Then they kind of circle around and circle around and circle around, and maybe they get a degree, but they're still unprepared for the work that needs to be done. So what we've thought about there from work that I've been doing with Commissioner Casilius and with Director Pogemiller is to find a way in which we earlier on get high school students to develop a plan that is a plan developed not in the vacuum of what their passions and interests are, which we want to respect, and we want them to run with their passions and interests, but we need to link up those passions and interests with where the jobs are and where the hot demand fields are. So, for example, most high school students don't have a clue about manufacturing or mechatronics. And they mostly have a stereotype, perhaps from their parents, that manufacturing is very, very dirty, greasy facilities where your hands come home filled with grease every single day. And if you've been in a modern manufacturing plant, you know it's nothing of the nature, nothing like that at all. It's all computerized, machine-driven, robotics. It's as high-tech as any field in our state. So how is it we get that on their radar screen? How is it we take a student that has an interest in building things and creating things and in computers and in technology and get them to see that there are jobs going unfilled today in Minnesota that have starting wages of $45,000 to $50,000 that you can get with 16 months of training? How do we get them to connect that passion and interest with the jobs that need to be done and with the educational institutions that will provide the credentials to get them ready for work? I think the secret here is putting the pieces together in new ways. If higher education just goes off and does its thing and imagines that they're preparing people, and if the workforce, industry, and business just sits there and says, woe is me, they're not delivering what we need, and K-12 sitting there doing their thing, we're never going to get to work. But if we could put all these sectors together and get the pieces to come together in far more powerful ways, we can solve that problem. And by the way, if we solve that problem, it's going to be a very, very big return for Minnesota, both because our businesses will have the people they need to grow, but also we'll have no trouble recruiting businesses here to Minnesota because they know we will be able to partner with them to get them the workforce they need, not just today, but tomorrow. So those are the projects we've embarked on to try to solve this very important problem.
Great. Thank you.
Chancellor Rosenstone, do you have a sense of the tools that you will need or what we as a legislature can provide you with in order to make that holistic synergy happen? I know you have been working with, Director Pogemiller and Commissioner Casilius.
Chair Bonoff, I thought you'd never ask. There are some tools we need help with and some things we don't need help with. With respect to the alignment of higher education with high school, there are some steps we are prepared to take, but we're going to need some help. So going back to the conversation with Senator Clausen, we're prepared to take those students who are ready to soar and help them soar sooner and more efficiently for the state of Minnesota. With respect to getting better information about the workforce needs of Minnesota and the hot jobs of the future in the hands of high school students, we have some ideas about how we can do that. We also have some ideas about how we can do a better job of taking students in high school and giving them a sense of whether they're really on track to be college ready. And if not, how do we move that developmental or remedial education that's now taking place in our colleges and universities back into high school? Let's do it right the first time and have more students prepared to begin college on track for the right kind of job. So there's a package of things we'd love to talk with you about on that front. There are places where we learned very clearly from the workforce listening sessions of things we need to do that we need help on. We heard loud and clear, regardless of the business sector or industry of this state, they want more students prepared on the equipment of today, not the equipment from 3 years ago. They want more students with hands-on experience through internships and apprenticeship, and we're going to ask for a partnership with the people of Minnesota to help make that possible. We also heard loud and clear that we need to grow in very important areas of growth in Minnesota. We know here in the metro area what the growth sectors are going to be. Itasca Group has identified what those sectors are. We also know manufacturing has to grow in central Minnesota. We know composite engineering has to grow in southeast Minnesota. We know biotech needs to grow in northeast Minnesota. We know that healthcare has to grow across Minnesota. How are we going to grow to make up the gap of 150,000 jobs and grow to ensure that 70% of our students who start high school are going to have a post-secondary credential? How are we going to do that? Now, we can do some of that through reallocation, but the amount of growth that has to occur to serve students in these very targeted ways in these high-growth industries is a place we're going to need some help. And so when we get together next time, we look forward to being able to identify those places where we need help. We also look forward to identifying those places where we're going to assume responsibility and do it ourselves. And we're also going to look forward to sharing with you places where I think we need a partnership, where together I think we can get it done.
Thank you. And Chancellor Rosenstein, you didn't talk about your graduation rates, because, you know, we as a committee have identified our commitment to focusing on degrees conferred rather than students enrolled. And so I wondered if you wanted to share with the committee where you are now and your objectives.
Yes, Chair Bonhoff would be pleased to. First, let me try to clarify why things are probably a little different in our system. We have many students that come to us not with the idea of seeking a degree, but for the idea of picking up the two or three or four courses they need to be prepared for the next level of their career or for the new technology in the workplace. So I want to be very careful that when we get into this, that we're not being penalized for doing exactly what it is you need us to do, which is provide that margin of training for people who want to jump to the new career. They're not coming for degrees. Secondly, we have another problem that we need to confront, particularly in our technical colleges, that many of our students get picked off by business and industry before they actually complete their degree. Now, according to the way we all do statistics, that constitutes a failure. I think we want to be pretty thoughtful before we say that someone who left a semester early to begin a $45,000 or $50,000 a year job has somehow failed. They may have gotten exactly what they wanted out of the deal, but it's going to count against us in those statistics. Similarly, if a student begins, let's say, at Normandale Community College, but after 1 year doesn't get her associate's degree but transfers to Winona State University or the University of Minnesota or Carleton, is that a failure? I think not. I think it's a success story for that student. So we want to be very careful how we look at these statistics. All that being said and done, we're nowhere close to where we should be. And as you saw on my next to last slide, it is a priority for me. It is a priority for our colleges, universities. It is a priority for our board. But the other thing we need to keep in mind is this. We can get you 90% completion rates very easily. It's very simple. I can produce that. The way to do it is to move from 35% of our students being Pell eligible down to 8%. We will not take students who do not have the full economic means at home to cover their education. I can do it by saying we're not going to create a seat for everybody. We're only going to create a seat for those students who graduate in the top 10% of their high school class. So I can produce big numbers on completion by becoming a very different system of colleges and universities. And that's where you'll see the very best completion numbers in our state and the very best completion numbers in the nation. That should not be my strategy. Nevertheless, so we're always going to have completion numbers that are not going to look as good as some of the privates or some of the institutions that only take the top 10% or only take students with 28 ACTs or above. Nevertheless, we are committed to the success of every single student we serve. But we are dealt a tougher hand, and we have taken on the responsibility of a tougher hand than other colleges and universities have done. So we have as a priority improving those completion rates, which are sitting at about 52%, I believe, at our colleges and about 51% at our universities. They need to rise. We have a specific set of strategies that we're pursuing to do so. There are a couple places where we need help to implement strategies which we know are working from the pilot programs we've run that we want to scale up statewide. And we got to do a better job getting to the finish line, and we're going to suggest some places where you can help us do it.
Thank you. Senator Peterson?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Chancellor and Trustee. And actually, I appreciate your outline of how you've maintained or controlled tuition rates, and it's a very compelling. Actually, I've been waiting for a member of the committee to ask that question, and it's been at the top of my mind the entire time. Graduation rates and any real substantive data as it relates to job placement or workforce is actually not included at all in the 18 pages of this package. And I actually went through the 41 pages of your guide to the universities, and it's also not included in there. And I guess I want to take slight issue with the suggestion that any members of the committee would even entertain the idea that you put out there about somehow we would reduce the amount of Pell Grant recipient students or anything like that in order to achieve a 90% completion rate, which, you know, is absolutely an unrealistic goal. I mean, there are very few institutions, especially state colleges and university systems, that would even come close to that number. But I think that being said, it's a very legitimate question. I mean, it gets really to the core of what you're there to do. And so with respect to what you said, and I do think there's, you know, obviously there's a lot of rationale as to why maybe your graduation rate isn't as high as some other people. You have to have, I'll ask a direct question. Do you have the ability to measure or quantify the number of students who are attending the university who aren't there to get a degree? So they're there to just complete a certification and industry certification or otherwise. Do you have an ability to measure the percentage of students that are there for that reason?
Chancellor.
Chair Bonhoff, Senator Peterson, first let me apologize. I was being a little facetious to try to sharpen the difference between us and others, not to suggest that either members of this committee or we would want to change our mission to exclude those students from our colleges and universities. So I apologize for that misunderstanding. Yes and no is the answer to your question. Yes, we know that there are some students that come only to get the specific credential or specific course to improve their skills, but we also know there are other students that come with one idea in mind and then change their mind. And how it is we count all that is, I think, the issue we'd have to work through. With respect to placement, over 80% of our graduates in our colleges and universities find work in their chosen or related field upon graduation. It's very high. And obviously, as you move into our technical programs, many of our technical programs are in the upper 90s because there's such high demand for those graduates. That is a number we track by program and by college and by university and for the system as a whole. So we'd be pleased to share those data with them. We have them, and it's one of the metrics we pay very careful attention to.
Madam Chair, just as a follow-up, I would just encourage you to try to get a handle around quantifying a legitimate graduation rate and those other things, and because, quite frankly, and with all due respect, it's a glaring omission from a lot of material that you've provided here. I mean, that's a major focus of many of the members of the committee, and it's really, again, getting at the ends that we're after in terms of providing. You know, we've talked a lot about a workforce that is capable in the year 2018. Well, it's hard to measure that when you're not putting out the basic numbers as to how many people you're graduating and whether or not you're actually preparing students to reach that 150,000 mark that you've mentioned. And so I know we're going to be back in 2 weeks, but I don't mean to be overly critical, but I think it's a very important issue. And then just one more thing on the outcomes that you've got some bullet points here on the goals that you have for the MNSCU system. And I would say again, while all of those things are very admirable goals for MNSCU, one of the questions I would have is, what are the concrete goals? And I know I didn't ask President Kaler this, but some of the key elements of goal setting is that it's specific, that you can measure it, that it's time specific. So when do you want to complete these things by? So I'd like to get a clearer picture of where you want to be as an organization. And I think that is the crux of what I'm trying to say. So yep. Thanks.
Chair Bonoff.
Senator Peterson.
Senator Peterson. I completely agree. I apologize for what might appear to be a superficial presentation of the goals. We have metrics around each of these. I also apologize for not including that topic in this presentation. We are prepared to do so. We know what our completion rates are and can share those with you. We also know what the specific targets are we have with respect to those completion rates and where we'll be in 2, 5, and 10 years on those targets. So with your permission, Chair Bonoff, since this is a topic and a priority that we want to bring to you in our next discussion, why don't I provide that background information as part of the presentation next time, as well as the specifics about the steps we want to take and where it's going to get us.
And, Chancellor, I actually put forward and have not gotten any disagreement around the table that our guiding principle and vision was that each and every Minnesota student would complete a post-secondary program. So I think that is where the heart and soul of the committee is.
Chair Bonoff, it's at the heart and soul of our colleges and universities to get you there.
Great. Senator Fischbach.
Madam Chair, Chancellor Rosenstone, I think you've been there almost 2 years now, if I remember correctly, just long enough that you're not the new guy anymore.
Chair Bonoff, Senator Fischbach, it's only been 18 months.
Okay.
And I get to be the new guy for at least to the end of this session.
Okay. Madam Chair, Chancellor Rosenstone, I guess I'm just wondering, in those 18 months, new guy, what are your overall observations? I mean, I remember visiting with you when you were really the new guy, and so I'm kind of wondering your observations over the last 18 months and impressions about the system, the campus, those kinds of things, just much more broadly than what we've been kind of getting at the specifics.
Chancellor.
Chair Bonoff, Senator Fischbach, several reflections. First and foremost, the faculty. The faculty really cares. They really care about students. They're putting their heart and soul into their students. They work very hard, have a lot of classes. And the success of their students, even the ones that are really, really challenged, is something they profoundly care about. Second, I was prepared for the very close relationship that exists between colleges and universities and their community, but really unprepared for the depth with which community leaders and business people feel that. Hardly a campus I visited during my first 10,000 miles around the state. I didn't have time to meet with the business community leaders or civic leaders, mayors, school board members, superintendents, where they would go on and on and on about how important this college or university is to our industry, to the culture of our community, to the economic vitality of the community. Very impressed by that. I think third, it's a pretty lean operation for the number of students we're serving. I've been in several universities over the 40 years I've been in education. I'm remarkably impressed with how much we're able to do with the limited staff and resources we have, the number of students we serve, and kind of in some cases the Rube Goldbarb way in which we put the pieces together just to get it to work and work in a way that serves students. The staff care a lot. I am a pretty early, even by Minnesota standards, riser in the morning and get to work pretty early, but there always seem to be people there that are there before I am and always people that are there after I leave. And no matter when I go to bed, there's new stuff waiting for me in my email first thing in the morning because there's people pounding away. The people I work with really care about, I think, the same values that this committee's expressed. I was prepared for that, but still overwhelmed by it over the months I've been on the job. I hope that helps. Good question.
Chair Bonoff.
Yes,
Chancellor
Senator Fischbach.
Rosenstone. Yeah, thank you very much. I mean, like I said, I remember visiting with you at the beginning, and it's good to hear that you're out there and talking to folks and understanding and getting a better because I think we all can say, you know, the faculty cares, but to really know it and to, you know, go out there and visit and understand it is important, and glad you're there.
Thank you.
Yep.
And Chancellor Rosenstone and Senator Fischbach, one of the things you asked President Kaler was to specifically address the things that your committee had as part of the performance management package. And so I asked Maya to get those out. And I do have them before us in statute, but you haven't mentioned that, but I understand you met all the measures. So anything?
I think there's one we fell short on, and unfortunately, I think it's the one you care most about.
Oh. Members, so for anybody who doesn't know, in the last omnibus bill for higher education, there was 1% set aside where you had to meet at least three of the five identified performance goals. So for MNSCU, it was, number one, increased by at least 7% compared to fiscal year 2009, graduates or degrees, diplomas, and certificates conferred. Number two, increased by at least 10% compared to fiscal year 2010, the number of students of color. Number three, increased by at least 15% compared to fiscal year 2010, the full year equivalent enrollment of students taking online or blended courses, or the number of online and blended sections. Number four, increased by at least 1% the fall 2011 persistence and completion rate for fall 2010 entering students compared to the fall 2010 for fall 29 entering students, and decreased by at least 2% compared to calendar year 2009 total energy consumption per square foot.
And,
Chancellor.
Chair Bonoff, as I mentioned, we hit four of those five.
Okay.
You will also see that when we get together next time, we will be suggesting performance metrics again. At specific places in our legislative proposal, we will be suggesting that if we do not hit certain benchmarks in year one, you do not release money for year two, that we are comfortable being held to performance metrics as long as we can work out ones that are reasonable and that we have a shot of achieving if we're stretching ourselves and pushing hard.
Thank you. Senator Miller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Chancellor, I have a follow-up to Senator Claussen's previous question about the credit transfers. And this is an issue that I've heard more than I thought I would from constituents in southeastern Minnesota. So I'm just going to give an example. If there's a student that's attending Southeast Technical and gets his or her degree, associate's degree in marketing, will those credits automatically transfer to Winona State, Metro State, Bemidji State, or who determines whether or not those credits transfer from a 2-year to a 4-year university?
Chancellor?
Chair Bonoff, Senator Miller, a great question. I can't answer the specific on that particular program at Southeast Technical College and Winona or Metro State. I would have to check for you. The short answer to your question is that it is the faculty at the university that decides whether to recognize those courses as prerequisites or equivalent to the courses that would have been offered at the university. And that's an example, if you will, Senator Miller, of where we don't mandate from the system office what the answer to that question is. Instead, the faculty at that university, local control, decide whether or not those courses will transfer. The most important thing from my point of view is that there be clarity for students about which courses will transfer and which courses will not transfer. Students need to know before they begin a program at one of our colleges whether the courses will transfer. I think 2 years ago, we completed an audit of transfer, And if I'm not mistaken, the number is 91%. 91% of the time transfer works exactly as you would hope it would. Of the remaining 9% where it didn't work exactly as we hoped it would, about half of the time there were mistakes that were made. And when the appeal was made by the student, the mistake was corrected. Then the remaining part that's left is this mismatch of information. Students were not aware of what the transfer policy were not aware when they started a course whether or not it would transfer, and we have since that audit taken the steps to increase awareness. So indeed, the ability of students to move with agility among our colleges and universities is a very high priority for the system, but we get into this balance between local autonomy, which we care deeply about, and Steve simply mandating, darn it, this is the way we're going to do it because I said so. Getting that balance right in a way that's also best for our students is part of what we have to work through, but do it in a way where students are aware of what those options are. The worst thing is for a student to be presuming they can go down a path of transfer, and they really can't. We don't want that to happen.
Yep, Senator
Chancellor,
Moore.
And I appreciate that, and I think it's extremely important that there's consistency. I'm not sure that one four-year institution should or shouldn't if the other ones aren't. What I'm trying to say is if Winona State's going to take that, but Metro State or St. Cloud or Mankato, they're not going to take those transfers, then there's some inconsistency there. And I do agree with you that it's extremely important that our students know ahead of time whether or not those credits are going to transfer or not, because that goes to meeting the needs of the workforce and everything else, making sure that our students graduate on time and that they're not there longer than they need to. So I think that's extremely important. And then one more follow-up on
Senator Miller.
Senator Peterson's question, Madam Chair and Chancellor, and you mentioned this, Chancellor. I think it's extremely important that, yes, as a committee, we look at graduation rates, but we also need to look at success rates, because you mentioned some of our students, and I think it's probably happening more in the two-year colleges than the 4 years, they're getting picked off. And I didn't realize this until I was on the campus of Minnesota State College Southeast Technical a couple of weeks ago, and this was a concern of theirs, because students before they're graduating, the industry's coming in because there's such a need for educated workforce that those students are leaving before they're completing that degree. So when you provide that information to us with graduation rates, I think it's also important that we as a committee look at success rates, how many of those students are being placed before graduation or before getting that degree.
Chancellor?
Yes.
Okay. I don't know. I understand, Senator Miller, that may be considered a success, but I think those are good questions to grapple with, because is that student well served sometimes with an early departure that could be future limiting later? But again, that is up to the student. One of the things that I would like not to have a discussion today, but for us to grapple with, is what is the role of a real mentor who has the student's best interests at heart, or a counselor, and what is your structure for fulfillment on the possibility of that? Because I think a mentor or a counselor can be, you know, hand in hand with a student to look at the pros and cons, and if there's a contract between that mentor and the student of fulfillment of a strategy, that can be changed, but at least there's something that allows when an obstacle gets in a student's way, like needing to eat or, you know, that we have a structure to just make sure we're doing what's best.
And Senator Madam Miller. Chair, I don't disagree with your comments, but at the same time, the reality is it's happening.
I know.
And so I think it's important as a committee that we see those numbers, and then we can decide what we want to do. And absolutely, we want to encourage our students to finish that program and get that certificate or degree or whatever it is. But at the same time, I think it's important that it's not we don't want to hold that against a college or university because those students are going out into the workforce.
Point well taken. Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I If you cover this, please let me know, and I'll just listen to the record. I am very excited about the conversations that you're having about connecting the high school experience with post-secondary experience. I think this is, I think these are fantastic ideas that could really help us move in a new direction. We could be an example for the nation. And I'm very intrigued. I'm just kind of looking forward to dive into that conversation. I would like to hear your thoughts. I have been thinking a lot about this and talking to several people. So people are very excited. Some members are very excited about the opportunities to really expand vocational, you know, again, the vocational experience, training young students in high school so that they will have more than just a diploma, have some tangible skills. Others are talking about expanding college credit programs, which is a different approach. Others are saying, absolutely, we shouldn't be talking about vocational because we did that, you know, in the 70s, we did that in the 60s, and then what we need is engineers that are competing with China, and we need doctoral degrees, we don't need vocational degrees. So we have, you know, all of these conversations going on right now, and I'm interested in all of them. I think that we have opportunities to explore each and every one. But I wonder, what are your thoughts? And from a practical perspective, how do you see this evolution of higher education from your experience? You know, you have ample experience in all of these sectors, and I am curious to hear your thoughts.
Yeah, sir.
Chair Bonhoff, Senator Torres-Ray, this is probably one of the most important conversations we can have this session. I think fundamental to the direction that we've been going is a very simple principle. The power of what we need to produce from Minnesota is going to come from putting the pieces together in new ways, not from each of us doing the same thing we've been doing all by ourselves. So the conversations that I've been having with Commissioner Casillas and with Director Pogemiller have focused on four things we need to do, and we've touched on just a couple of those already. The first thing we need to do is align our assessments. The standard for high school graduations here, the standard for being ready to begin college-level classes is here. And unless we start giving information earlier on to students, parents, teachers, and schools that student's not ready for college, and the only way they find out whether they're ready is the first day they come to one of our colleges, universities, and take a test and discover they can't begin college-level classes, that's not a good system. And so we need a way of being able to say to a student, perhaps starting as early as the eighth grade, you're on track. If you're on track and you reach that point where you're prepared to take a college-level class, whether it's in technical education or mathematics or chemistry, that you can begin and get college credit for that work before you graduate high school. And Senator Claussen and I had some conversation about that. If you are not on track to being college ready, let's bring that remedial and developmental education back into high school so that every single student who graduates high school is prepared to begin college level work. And that can only happen if we have an alignment of these assessments. Then the last part is, let's find a way in which we match students' passions, interests, and desires with the work that needs to be done. So if a student is really interested in becoming a nuclear physicist, but she doesn't have the math that's going to get her to the starting gate on being a nuclear physicist, we have to have an honest conversation saying, well, if you want to be a nuclear physicist, this is what you need to do. And if you're prepared to do it, you can become a nuclear physicist. But if you're not prepared to do it and you have these interests and passions and goals, here's some other pathways we can help create for you that'll get you a great job, because that work needs to be done. It's not a debate between the PhD engineers and the people in mechatronics. We need both. If we're a state that just has big ideas but can't put them to work to build things, we're not going to get to where we need to go any more than if all we can do is build things, but we have no innovative ideas about how to accomplish it. Both have to be there. So I don't think we want to get into a debate between whether we need just one or the other. We need both. But I think if we can figure out how to get higher education and K-12 aligned in a way that doesn't create these surprises when students graduate, that lets students soar when they're ready to soar, that gets students help when they need it, and that gets better information about the career paths that are ahead for students earlier into the pipeline, I think we can produce hugely valuable results for Minnesota, particularly among those students who traditionally have not been well served by higher education but must be served if Minnesota is going to be competitive and they're going to have life-sustaining jobs.
Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just very excited about this conversation as well. And, Madam Chair, it's just as I think a lot about this and think about, you know, the role that you will play in this and the role that I will play and the role that members in these different committees will play in trying to help us shape these great ideas and bring the practical steps, I feel kind of the urgency to start kind of building a committee of members. I know Senator Peterson and others are in the different committees, and so that we can begin to think about, you know, how do we establish a practical conversation about these steps, because we're going to be doing a lot of hearings about assessments and tests, and so it will be great to see, you know, how do we connect this really early on, because I'm concerned about the practicality of these steps that we're going to take, and how do we go about, you know, kind of doing this the right way and just kind of in a very from a very practical perspective, because ideas are wonderful and I think people want to move in this direction. So what are some of the steps that we need to take?
Senator Torres-Ray, I have the same both anticipation and sense of hopefulness around the conversation, but also the same concern in that, you know, here we are, we've been meeting now a couple weeks, and when are we going to bring these together? And so I'm hopeful that as we hear the MNSCU proposed budget and I meet with the Office of Higher Education, that I'll begin to see their recommendations for how that might work. But you're going to hear them from a different perspective, and I think it's important for members to feel freedom to at any time present an approach for how to put it together, and we'll take it from everywhere we get it. But I share your commitment that this session, that we not leave here without finding a new way to integrate K-12 and higher ed and workforce, that all three, by the time we finish session, have a new model for driving the ultimate completion, which is our, you know, our young people's success.
Yeah, and I think we have Senator Clausen, Senator Peterson,
Senator Kent. Yeah.
Are in the three committees, if I'm not mistaken, policy, yep. Finance.
But we'll work together.
Thank you.
Senator Sharon.
Thank you. I appreciated this last conversation, too. I'm with Senator Bonhoeff, and the conversation seems to me has described, and there's been a lot of admiration of this problem and not much in the form of real action or proposal, and I'm fatiguing a conversation. I'm really ready for some recommendations. But my comment really was in relationship to Senator Miller's concern, and I'm interested. If this has been discussed, I want to first of all apologize for not hearing your fabulous presentation. I'm sure it was, but I was in another committee. And I want you to know I would have preferred to have come and had a chance to listen to your presentation. But this issue of completion, I think that I would look forward to a discussion about that, because when we have students that drop out for whatever reason, whether it's because they're picked off by an employer or they have to go back into the workplace in order to earn enough money in order to complete their education, or who knows what the reason is, the state has already made an investment in that education. At least we used to do it at 63%, 66%. Now it's at 50%. So when you have a person who's 2 years into a four-year education and they leave, we've really abandoned challenged that investment that we've made. So I think that for lots of reasons, the state has an interest in setting some systems in place that encourage completion, 2-certificate, 4-year, doesn't make any difference, whether it's some tuition forgiveness if you get done, or some other kind of proposal that recognizes or assists students to understand, which I don't think they fully understand sometimes, that there is a partnership being made with them from the state, that we're putting money into your education, and for you to not complete that. And then finally, I don't know if you've got a proposal or if anything's been presented here that goes back, because when we're looking for students to fill those jobs in the future, and they need to have an advanced education, we ought to be looking at these students who have already entered our system, whether it's the University of Minnesota or Minsku, that have several years already. They've met the admission criteria. They don't have to go back and take courses over because they didn't get it in high school. They're already engaged in the process of getting an education. Contact them. Ask them, what can we do to get you back into the educational system? Because we've made an investment there, and I think we should make an investment in getting them back in the system.
Chair Bonhoff, Senator Sharon, we are on the same page. I've returned to the next to last slide in my presentation, which foreshadows the three priorities we want to talk about when we're talking about the next session. We are in complete agreement. Accelerating completion is a priority for what we want to do together in the next session. And we will return to that conversation with some ideas as well of how we can do so. We're on the same page. With respect to your suggestion of helping students that stepped out to complete, our universities are doing precisely that. In fact, you may have even seen some billboards around town about that. Metro State here in the metro area has been on a campaign to help students who stopped finish. I completely agree with you. Some students are so close that with a little extra nudge and encouragement, we can get them to the finish line. And so we can share with you some of the initiatives that we've been pursuing to follow through exactly on your idea.
Thank you, Senator Sharon. Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Chancellor Rosenstone, you backing up to the point we were talking about a couple of questions ago, you had used your hands as a visual as to where our high school students were and where they ought to be entering college, and you had mentioned that those students are going to be taking a test, and oftentimes that test reveals that there's remedial education that's needed in order to meet college-level courses. One of the luxuries of serving on all the education committees is I get a view of when there's contradictory proposals between the committees, and one of them, there are people in state government who believe that we ought to do away with measuring certain levels of proficiency at the end of the high school career. You had mentioned that upon entry, individuals are taking tests to measure proficiency in certain levels. There are some who would like to eliminate tests at the end of high at the grad test in particular, at the end of the high school career. And so there's somewhat of a contradiction there in measuring. You know, some people, I think it's the governor's proposal, would like to eliminate the grad test. At the same time, you're saying we need to make sure that students are at this minimum level of competency to perform college-level courses. So could you maybe give some insight into how we can reconcile those two differences of opinion? And I don't want to put you on the hot seat with the governor, but, you know, that there's a clear, as you can see, there's a clear contradiction there between one person's viewpoint and what you've suggested as an issue in post-secondary. So could you delve into that a little bit and maybe an alternate suggestion for this committee and the other education committees so that we can reach that level of competency for those students?
Thank you, Chancellor.
Senator Bonhoff, Senator Peterson, this is probably the most dangerous territory I could wander into in the state of
it's
Minnesota
exciting,
right
though.
Now. Exciting. I'm very pleased to hear that. We cannot have students come to our colleges and universities who are not prepared to do college-level work. And to follow up on an earlier conversation we had here this afternoon, if we aren't able to assess whether they're ready for college work, if we aren't willing to share with them that assessment and give that feedback so that if they want to be ready and they're not, there are things that can be done so they will be ready, we're never going to meet the workforce needs of Minnesota or ensure that we have individuals who are going to be able to have sustainable wages and live happy, healthy lives. I think it's wrong for someone to find out the weekend before Labor Day that they aren't prepared for college when they thought they were. I think that's just wrong. And it's wrong. We worry about completion. It's wrong for them to have to spend out of their own money, not out of state grant, not out of Pell Grant, the dollars to get themselves ready to begin their college education. And if we worry about completion, many students fail to get to the starting gate, let alone the finish line, as a result of this additional time they have to spend. I think that's just wrong, and I think it's bad policy, quite frankly, that we got to pay a second time. So how can we figure out how to do it right the first time? Well, part of it is just being clear what it means to begin college-level work. It would be an equally bad mistake for us to take any student, regardless of their capabilities, and throw them in a college-level course. We'd be wasting the state's money. We'd be wasting the student's money. We're setting up a student for failure. And he or she won't get to the finish line that way either. So part of it's just clarity about what that standard is. If I'm a parent and don't know whether my son or daughter's on track to being ready for the next step that he or she aspires to, that I aspire to for my child, something's missing there. Before we get into the quagmire of whose test is better and what test we're going to use and what we assess and don't assess, just if we just step back for a moment and just say, what's best for the kids? And what's best for the end game we're trying to produce for our state, which is helping students get the education they need so they can do the work to make their lives the lives they want to lead, and by the way, help our businesses and communities thrive, it just has to be fixed. Whether it means not getting into the debate over assessment and just adding a new one because we can't afford to get into the horrible politics of that debate, I will leave that to other committees and other members to figure out. What I would love to see accomplished here is a way in which there's fewer surprises for students when they arrive, that more students arrive ready to go, that we stop doing remedial education at our colleges and universities, and that we're creating a faster, more efficient, better way for people to hit the ultimate finish line, which we're all trying to get them to. So I'm doing my best to dodge your political question.
Doing well.
Thank
Very
you.
Very eloquent.
But I'm just trying to step back and say, so what makes sense for kids?
Maybe if I could.
Senator Peterson.
And I'll editorialize a little bit here, if I can. Isn't it true that, you know, we can lower the bar for high school graduation all that we want and artificially increase high school graduation rates if that's what we want to do, but we can't lower the bar for entry to the marketplace and the workforce? And it's a critical question that the members of this committee and that this legislature will take up is you can't ignore the realities that these people need to be proficient in certain areas in order to enter college, as you've stated. And they're going to take a test anyway as soon as they get to college. And certainly not the realities of post-secondary and the workforce after that. And I think it's just a point that I wanted to drive home. So thank you for letting me do so, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Peterson.
Chair Bonoff, with your permission. There are entire forests that have been killed off to publish the work done on completion. And the central finding from volumes and volumes and volumes of work is the two best predictors of whether someone's going to complete a degree is academic preparedness and met financial need. I want to improve academic preparedness because that's going to help me with this other thing we all really care about, which is completion. And increasing access and affordability is the other thing I want to do, both to meet our mission as a set of colleges and universities, meet the workforce needs of the state, but also help us drive this completion agenda. But if at the end of the day we don't have as part of our arsenal dealing with preparation and dealing with affordability, we're never going to get to where we need to be on this completion agenda, which we're in agreement we need to be moving forward.
Thank you. Well, members, did you have something, Senator?
One question, Madam Chair. Thank you very much. Trustee Rainier and Commissioner, or Chancellor, are there, I guess, having served on a school board for a number of years, I'm sensitive to the policy aspects of what you have to deal with. Are there obstacles, mandates that hamper your ability to serve your students from a policy standpoint that we should be addressing?
You're asking me that.
Sure. Come on into the conversation.
Mr. Rainier.
I'm Chair Bonoff, thank you. I assume there are. I don't think I can articulate them at this point, but we've, as a board, particularly over the last 2 years or so, have charged the chancellor and staff with identifying barriers to doing what it is we're supposed to do. We know that there are some. We know that there are policies that have been put in place that have become traditions or become habits that aren't just policies that affect efficiencies, but that affect our ability to do what we're charged with doing. That's probably about as specific as I can get right now. But it is on our radar.
Thank you.
Thank you. Well, members, I think we've had a great discussion. Chancellor, thank you for your presentation. Mr. Rainier, are you Dr. Mr.? Okay, thank you. Thank you for doing that. Before members leave, I just want to go over just a couple housekeeping things. So this coming Thursday, we will begin at 3:30, not 3 o'clock. We won't end late, but we will just start at 3:30, not 3 o'clock, because we do, if we say we're going to start it at a certain time, we start then. And members, I understand that you have conflicting committees. Thank you very much for letting us know, checking in. It makes a big difference. And then also I want to remind members, because I don't know that it's on everyone's radar, that on the 29th, instead of going to committee, that the entire Senate has been invited to go to the University of Minnesota, transportation provided, for a very engaging and informative tour, and then a chance to have a reception with President Kaler. And so we'll be making sure all the other committees know as well, but each one of us has gotten a letter in our mail about that. So with that, committee's adjourned. Thank you.